Well, if you have a Bible, do encourage you to turn to John chapter 12 and verse 20, which is found on page 1080. Come with me to Jerusalem, joining with thousands of other pilgrims gathering for the festival of Passover. Imagine the scene, a city bursting with life. Perhaps somewhat upwards of 700,000 or 800,000 people coming for this great festival. And somewhere, almost perhaps lost in that vast crowd, are a handful of Greeks. How appropriate that John, who wrote this gospel, should seek them out and add them to these words. Because the gospel of John had a special purpose: to present the truth of Christianity in a way that Greeks, Gentiles, non-Jews could appreciate it and understand it. It does seem from what is written that they were genuine seekers, because by asking to see Jesus, they really meant they wanted to talk seriously with him. So these were people he wanted to get beyond and past the fake news to the real news. Now, one commentator has even suggested that they might have been present at the temple a few days earlier when Jesus had turned over the tables of the money changers in the court of the Gentiles, the only court in the temple that people like these Greeks could have worshipped in, a court that had become a marketplace. And Jesus had turned over those tables symbolically to say, "My house is to be a house of prayer for all nations." So maybe that little instance that they were involved in got them thinking that this Jesus, he's for us too, even though we're not Jews. This Jesus is for you too, whether or not you've been coming to church for a long time. Perhaps this is the first time you've come to church for a very long time. If you're genuinely seeking something about him, he will meet you here today. So what does Jesus say to them in response as they're brought to him? Well, John Stott, a Christian writer, says this: their request seems to have lit an exploding fuse in his mind. Up to this point in the gospel, Jesus has consistently said that his hour has not yet come. But now, the now has arrived. The climax is here. The hour has come, he says, for the Son of Man to be glorified. Now, to fully understand this rather unusual phrase, the Son of Man, we need to go back to Daniel, a prophet many hundreds of years before, and to his world, because that's the first time we hear this phrase, the Son of Man. Now, in Daniel's era, the surrounding nations, the Assyrians, the Philistines and others, were so cruel and savage that they could only be described under the terms of wild beasts. So they were likened to lions or leopards or bears with iron teeth. The prophet Daniel's dream in that context was for a new kind of power, one that was humane and gracious under the symbol of a man. Now, for the Jewish people, that image grew over centuries in their minds to bring them to this point. They believed that they would be sent a heavenly deliverer, a champion, one who would bring an end to all their suffering. And they were suffering plenty in Jesus' day. They were under the harsh rule of the Roman Empire. You see, they had become convinced that there's a tiny, tiny nation in a blip of this enormous empire. That their salvation would never come by human effort. It would only be by God sending his champion on a horse, a world conqueror. So when they heard the word glorified, what would come into their minds was that the rest of the world would be subdued by God's Savior. And the rest of the world would grovel at his feet. Now, you could forgive the Greeks hearing these words for missing out on the symbolism. But if you were a Jew, you would have absolutely got it. And inside your heart, you would have been excited. The Son of Man is to be glorified. Are the end times coming? Are we going to be rescued? But glory to Jesus meant something quite different. To Jesus, glory didn't mean a conquering army, but a donkey. And we'll discover more about that next week. That donkey that he sat on would take him into the city, where he would be tried unjustly, where he would be stripped and beaten and flogged, and finally face a humiliating and agonizing walk to his death. A death outside the city on a rubbish heap, nailed to a cross. That was for Jesus glory. And he now continues with a series of sayings which turn their ideas upside down. He turns their dream of conquest into a vision of the cross. Many didn't understand him. And sadly, many refused to understand him. I pray that none of us fall into that trap here today. Jesus here says three things, all variations of one truth, and all at the heart of the Christian faith. Firstly, only by death comes life. Look at verse 24. I bought my seeds for the vegetable patch yesterday. Don't know if you've got yours yet, or if perhaps some of you are ahead of the game and you're beginning to plant things in those warm corners. So my seeds at the moment are in their packets on the kitchen table. I felt sorry for them for some reason last night. I didn't want to even go and put them in the shed. It was so cold. I thought that would be a bit unkind. But of course, at some point in the near future, I have to dig a hole in the ground. And I have to place those seeds in the dark, cold soil with the hope that they will germinate and come to life. You see, it was by the sacrifice and the death, the burying literally of the early Christians, set the example by Jesus, that the church grew. Someone once said that the blood of the martyrs is the seedbed of the church. It has always been thus. And even today, in places where to be a Christian is to be on a hit list, thank God that it is not yet a reality here in our country. But in a very personal way, and if we bring this to ourselves personally, and I hope that none of us will have to lay down our lives in that way. There are other things, I think, nevertheless, that we do have to lay down in order for things to grow. In a personal way, it seems to me that it's only when we bury our personal ambitions, our personal desires, that stuff really grows spiritually in us. That we can then become of real use to God. I was watching a little bit of the funeral of Billy Graham last week, and it struck me about that man that he spent his whole life laying down his personal desires to live a simple life full of integrity, a life that was hugely used by God. He could have become a megastar, couldn't he? He could have become so much more in the world's eyes, but he chose not to, to keep doing what he felt called to do. Now, don't get me wrong, we're not all called to be Billy Grahams, but God has a hand upon your life and mine. And part of that hand on our lives may be something to do with us laying down our personal ambitions to take up his ambition for us. See, this is how Jesus started it off. His glory did not come by bulldozing the opposition with a conquering army or even drawing the seekers by satisfying their curiosity. It was only won by his sacrifice. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians, "The cross is a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Greeks." It's no different today, is it? But it is a rather crazy thing in some ways that we, you and me, gather around a church, a faith that is based upon this one Friday event, Good Friday. So the first thing Jesus says is that only by death comes life. The second thing is that only by spending life do we keep it. Look at verse 25. Don't love this life too much, or you will be motivated by your own enhancement and your own security. And those are very, very demanding masters. When Joan of Arc knew that her enemies were near and she could only have a few months left, she said, "I shall last only a year. Use me as you can." How would this world be if there weren't people prepared to forget their personal safety, to forget security, to forget selfish ambitions? We owe a huge debt to people who give their strength and give themselves to God and to others. We may exist longer if we avoid all risks in life, but I don't think we will really experience life in all its fullness. Only by spending life do we keep it. Finally, only by service comes greatness. Verse 26. The people the world remembers with love are the people who serve others. Think of your own role models. Think of the people that you model yourselves on. A schoolboy was once asked, "What parts of speech are me and mine?" And without realizing the significance of what he was saying, he put his hand up and said, "Sir, they're aggressive pronouns. Me and mine." There are too many people today whose only purpose in life is, "What can I get out of it? What can I receive?" Not, "What can I give?" Now, the last few verses, verse 27 onwards, explore the journey that Jesus goes on from tension to certainty. Verse 27 must allude to the wrestling that he goes through in the Garden of Gethsemane. Nobody wishes to die. Jesus wasn't a masochist. There would have been no virtue in his obedience if it had cost nothing to him. He showed real courage. You see, real courage is not something that's shown in the absence of fear. No, real courage is when you fear something greatly, but keep going. And for Jesus, the end of the story is not tension, but triumph and certainty. Jesus knew that if he was obedient and obedient to death, then a death blow would be struck to the ruler of this world, the prince of this world, the devil himself. Jesus was also certain that if he went to the cross, if he was raised on that tree, he would in the end draw men unto himself. So what came between these two things? The tension of verse 27 and the triumph of verse 31. What happened in between to turn tension into triumph? Look and see with me at verse 28. The voice of God. You see, once upon a time, the Jews believed that God did speak to people, like he spoke to Samuel, the child, and Elijah, the prophet. But then for many, many years, the Jews believed that God had been silent because they couldn't hear him, or they said they couldn't hear him. But with Jesus, God was here. The word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood, so it says in the message. And with him, God's voice is no longer a distant whisper, but direct and audible. What Jesus needed to hear, just as when God convinced him that he was his beloved son at his baptism, what Jesus needed to hear now was that God was in control. Just when his human flesh and his blood needed to be strengthened, God spoke. And what God did for Jesus, he will do for us. When he sends us out on a road, he doesn't send us without directions or guidance or help. When he gives us a task, he doesn't expect us to do it in our own strength. Our God is not a silent God. And ever and again, when the strain of life is too much for us, or that the effort of doing things God's way is beyond our human resources, if we listen, we will hear him speak. And we will go on with his voice ringing in our ears and his strength surging through our body. Our trouble is not that God does not speak, but that we do not listen enough.